The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Teresa.
Hi, I'm Teresa. I'm an alcoholic. First, I just want to say that it's an honor and privilege to speak at an AA meeting, especially here at my enormous home group. I will just tell you my stats first, I guess, and then get on with it, because once I start talking, I can't stop, much like my drinking. It's the only joke I had. So I got sober on July 10th, 2014. I am a member of the Atlantic Group, and Rachel B. is my sponsor. I sponsor other women, and I have been through the 12 steps. I'm currently working on 10 through 12, 9 through 12, actually. So if, you know, 2.5 years ago, the solution to all of my problems, which I had brought on myself, I didn't know that at the time, but was to, that I didn't want to live anymore. So what I would do, you know, I would fantasize about being hit by a cab or a bus, or, finally, the last night of my drinking, you know, I thought I would just end my life, and luckily that didn't happen. I said something to a few people and was sort of intercepted, and, you know, to back up a little bit, I grew up, a goody two-shoes, and alcoholism, you know, definitely runs in my family. Luckily, you know, so does recovery in the program. And, you know, from a very young age, you know, whether or not I was born an alcoholic, I don't know. I did overdose on Flintstone vitamins when I was like 3. My parents left the bottle in my room, and I can picture it so vividly. I remember seeing it like shimmering, and I ate the whole bottle and had to be taken to the hospital. Then I got straight A's. I was always kind of fascinated with addiction and alcoholism because, you know, I grew up around it and recovery, but I was so curious about it. And I remember thinking in about 7th grade that when I got to high school, I wanted to start a group for young people to talk about, you know, that you don't need drugs or alcohol to have fun. And, you know, I had all these grand ideas. I felt like that was my mission. And sure enough, you know, there was a different plan in mind. I had my first drink right before I started high school. And while I did not have that white light, amazing experience, it definitely set in motion, you know, what was to take course over the next, you know, almost 20 years. But, you know, basically it went from my dream being, you know, to sort of, you know, be this spokesperson for, you know, sober living in high school. And within a week of high school, I had this mission to be the biggest partier. And, you know, I succeeded. We had the yearbook superlatives there. We had this, like, sort of informal one. And I was on the short list for most likely to be on America's Most Wanted. That was what I had come to senior year. I still managed to get good grades, but, you know, the effects were already taking hold. I went to college, and I thought, this is a new start. Again, within weeks, same story, you know, but now it was really, you know, it was just, I was sort of in a playground, and, you know, while I did maintain grades and graduated college, it was very much, you know, I started out pre-med, and I ended with a degree in philosophy. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it kind of shows you, you know, the amount of work I was willing to put in. So my life started really taking shape around my drinking. You know, at some point drugs were introduced, and they're definitely part of my story, but it always started and ended with drinking. So, you know, after college, I decided to stay in the same town I was in for school. And I'll never forget, and this was at about 22, 23, I was at a magic show with my friends, and during the intermission, there was a palm reader. So I go to the palm reader, and she reads my palm, and I go to my friend after, and she said, "What did she say?" And I said, she said that when I was 29 or 30, I was going to go through the most difficult time of my life. It was going to be extremely sad and difficult, horrific, whatever she said. And my friend said, "Oh no, what do you think it means?" And I said, "I'm going to have to stop drinking and admit that I'm an alcoholic." You know, thereby admitting I was an alcoholic. And she looked at me, she was dumbfounded, and she said, whoa, if someone told me that, I would think like my family was going to die. And I was like, wow, yes, that is like more than anything else that could happen to me. You know, sickness, death, family dying. Having to stop drinking was like my absolute biggest fear. You know, I couldn't imagine anything worse. And admitting that I was an alcoholic. And you know, my drinking, you know, I have so many stories I could tell, but really it's the same as, you know, most of us in here. It was tragic and sometimes fun, but usually really embarrassing and really sad. And, you know, I sort of surrounded myself with people who drank like I did. And finally, I was in a relationship where, you know, it was really, you know, my alcoholism really had just kind of, you know, sped ahead to the next level. And at this point, I was living in New York. And we went to a couples therapist. And I really didn't want to go because I knew I would be found out. Like, I knew it wouldn't take long because, you know, I had admitted to myself 7 years ago and to my friend that I was an alcoholic. But I just kind of, you know, I would always play this game with myself. Like, as long as, you know, I would say if I get drunk 7 more times, if I black out this many more times. And I would always set up new rules once that happened because, of course, it did. And so, you know, that therapist said, well, I think you're an alcoholic, and didn't say that to my boyfriend at the time, which killed me. And she said, you need your own help. And I went to that therapist, and she said, you need AA. And I said, it's not going to happen. I couldn't imagine it. Like I said, my solution was I thought I was either going to wake up in a hospital bed, and they would say, do you know what you did? And I would have no idea, because once I started drinking, who knows where I would end up, with whom, doing what, and I'm not a mean person, but I would do whatever it took to get what I wanted and to kind of, you know, just zone out. And, you know, finally, I remember my mom saying years ago, you know, she planted the seed, and she said, once you surrender, you know, God takes care of the rest. And at that point, I didn't believe in God, you know, I kind of brushed it off. But, you know, after that particular night that was increasingly, you know, they were all like that, I woke up in my sister's bed, and she said she had been rubbing my back all night to try to get me to sleep. And she said, what are we going to do? I can't go on like this. You can't keep doing this. And I said, oh, I'm done. You know, that's it. I want to go to rehab. I want to do whatever I can. And I can't explain that because, like I said, my solution was to kill myself. So I don't know, you know, that was the grace of God, really, that came in. And sure enough, like my mom said, you know, everything kind of took care of itself. I was introduced to the Atlanta Group when I had 7 days, met Rachel, my sponsor, who asked me to speak, thank you, if I didn't say that already. And, you know, I said, okay, great, but you're not like me. I don't think you understand, you know, the things I've done. And she told me a couple stories, and I was like, okay, you know, all right, maybe you are, you know, maybe these people aren't just, you know, not cool because they don't drink anymore. Maybe they can't drink anymore like me, which is the coolest, you know. And so I said, I'll go to meetings, but I'm not going to do the steps. And she said, no, you're going to do the steps. And, you know, it was like I was desperate. And so I just listened to her. I listened to every word she said most of the time. And, you know, I went through the steps, and we did it really quickly, which I needed. You know, and I can't say enough that if you're new and, you know, you need a sponsor, if you feel like you are just defective or, you know, that you have this dark soul that can't be helped, it's not true. That's exactly how I felt. You know, I remember the first time in this room I heard soul sickness, and I just, like, I couldn't believe it. You know, like, talk about white light experience. I was like, that's exactly it. That's what I have, you know. I have soul sickness. You know, I'm not a bad person. I'm a sick person. And, you know, since then, doing the steps and, like, forging this connection with a higher power, which is not, you know, the God I grew up with, because, of course, I rebelled against that my whole life. You know, but it does say in the big book that, you know, while we're out judging people, and, you know, a philosophy major, you know, I would drink until all hours of the morning debating people on religion. You know, meanwhile, people are getting up to go to church or pray, and they're actually living useful, happy lives, you know, and mine was just absolutely, you know, I was of no use to anyone. And, you know, now, you know, more will be revealed. I remember someone said, you know, that if you're looking at the picture, you know, this close up, you can't see it, and you're frustrated, and you think that you're going to feel like this forever. And I remember at 5 months thinking, wow, I haven't thought about a drink. You know, the obsession had been lifted. I don't know when, but somewhere in my first 5 months, it had been completely lifted. And, you know, not every day was about not drinking. It was about, you know, living, which I didn't think was possible. And so I just want to thank everyone in this room for my sobriety. And if you're new, welcome home. I hope you stay and you never have to drink again. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Rich.
My name is Rich. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank the Atlantic Group for asking me to speak, although right now gratitude with all these people is not the word that comes to mind. It's more like panic. But anyway, my sobriety date is May 15, 2003. I'm a member of the Atlantic Group. Thank you. Rajesh is my sponsor. We're doing the work right now. I'm on the fourth step, and I'm a transfer student. I spent the last 12 years out in Bedford Village, It's Guaranteed Group, and in Westchester, and originally I had gotten sober at the Midnight Group downtown. And I guess the bottom line for me is that I loved everything about drinking and partying from the beginning. You know, music, laughter, all the hope in the world. I admired rock stars and movie stars, and I was all in. And mostly what I liked about it was I liked the way it made me feel. It gave me self-confidence and self-esteem, and I was really smart and really successful when I drank. And I had the courage to ask a girl to dance. You know, not really, but you get the drift. And so that's what was driving me, you know. And I drank in high school. I grew up here in New York. I drank in high school, which was really just a precursor to college because that's where it really took off for me. I knew I had made the right choice in colleges because when I found out the football coach's name was Jack Daniels. And I thought that was a pretty good omen. And in college, I majored in binge drinking and the Grateful Dead, and I minored in pharmaceuticals. And that really was what it was all about. You know, I was extremely immature, and I thought I had arrived, you know. And ultimately, I was that person from 1986 until 2003. I drank myself into a psych ward. And you know, some things had changed externally. I got married and I was a father of two beautiful daughters. And a lot had also changed internally. All that hope and light, was replaced with, I was ashamed and embarrassed about the things that I had done and failed to do. I was hopeless. I was fearful. I was resentful and I was a beaten, broken man. And that, of course, that paradox of hopelessness is where it all began for me. Another part for me is that my parents are in AA. They're here tonight, so that's good. You know, they're a tremendous power of example, and, you know, they've got 39 years of continuous sobriety, but growing up, that is exactly what I did not want, right? Okay? You know, I wanted to have a normal life, which meant, red wine at Thanksgiving and, you know, champagne at graduation. And of course for me, that meant, you know, Budweiser and eight balls for breakfast, you know? And so I did not, ever want to do this. This is nuts, you know? And, you know, but anyway, I went to rehab after the psych ward and I joined Midnight Group and I counted days and my first meeting was at Perry Street and I got a sponsor and I loved the guy when we were doing the first three steps and then I hated him when he asked me to do a fourth step. And, you know, I started to drift basically. And then I was lucky enough to move out to Westchester, get involved in a home group that required you to do the steps to have service commitments and things like that. And, you know, my life really took off. I got involved sponsoring people, going through the book. I had stumbled into a Joe and Charlie meeting early in sobriety. You know, I did every service commitment in my home group. I applied the principles in all my affairs. I got turned on to GSR and CNE and all this stuff. And my life took off. for 10 of the 12 years. Because the last 2 years, I started to put other things in front of my sobriety. And we all know what happens when you do that. You start to drift, and you start to think you're the man, and the ego rebuilds itself. And I was lucky, and I was completely unemployable. I was in the psych ward, but my career took off because of Alcoholics Anonymous. But you see, what had really happened was is that I had forgot that I was just a newcomer with some time. That's all I am, you know, and I've learned that the hard way. And I had a tsunami of life start to hit me, real life. Parents of two teenage daughters, dissolution of a marriage, professional ups and downs. And but I was living on the fumes of prior work. And I migrated back to New York, and I was disconnected. I had heard about this group. My mother and parents had suggested, you know, the Atlantic group, you know, maybe you know, they know Peggy, et cetera, and they probably know that I need structure and organization. And so I came. My sponsor had told me never sit in the last row. That's denial aisle and relapse row. So I sat in the second to last row. And I came here, and, like, who cannot? The energy is contagious, you know, but I was like, I'm in a room with 600 people and I don't know anybody. Like, there's just no way, you know. But I remember sitting up here and they'd say, like, oh, the Atlantic group is going to the beach. And I'd be like, well, here's, you know, I could do, you know. But then I'm like, oh, I'm the weird guy, the new guy with a towel. You know, I'm not going to do that. You know, and then it was like the Atlantic group was having a picnic, you know. And I'm like, ah, oh, damn, picnic, you know. But then there's just more people that I don't know, you know. So I was like, no, you know, next time. And then I got really, really sick out of thin air. And I spent 6 days in the hospital. Life was catching up with me, totally disorganized, disconnected from my home group. I sat there one day, and it's a true story, the TV didn't work, and my kids had stolen my charger, and I didn't have anything to distract myself. And I was staring out the window, and I said, you know, I got to get my life together. And when I get out of here, I'm going to go in, I'm going to join the Atlantic group, and I'm going to get it together. I came that next Tuesday, I sat in the back, you know, then everybody at the end of the meeting, you know, they're like laughing, and there's a long line for the speaker. I'm like, no, you know, I can't do it. And then it all came back to me. Don't quit before the miracle. You can have a life beyond your wildest dreams. You know, it was agreed at the beginning that you'd go to any length for victory over alcohol. God is either everything or it's nothing. What's the choice? So right there I said, I'm going to start over from scratch. I got up. I went over. We used to have, you know, the guy on the bed. Now we have the man with the sign, you know. And I went over to the membership thing, and I signed up and whatever. You know, and the guy said to me, I don't even know who it was. He said, I gave him my sobriety day, whatever. He's like, good for you. Now, I don't know if he meant good for you, you got 13 years. Good for you, you got 13 years in joining the AG. Or just good for you. But whatever it did, it opened up the door of willingness. And then he said it. He gave me a sentence. You know when we hear that sentence in AA where it changes your whole life? It's incredibly wisdom-based with spiritual, incredible wisdom. You're like, wow, why didn't I think of that? He said, bro, how about a commitment? You know? And I turned around. I said, well, how do we do that? He's like, just turn around, dude. And there was smiling, enthusiastic Rachel T., who assigned me to be a greeter. I can tell you the difference between sitting in that second-to-last row and being a greeter is night and day. You know, you start to get involved, you meet people, you know, whether people are saying hi, Rich, because they're looking at my name tag isn't the point. You know, the fact is that you start to meet people, you know, and you get involved and you get engaged, et cetera. And you know what I did, you know, when the next time it came up, I did do caroling, which was excellent, by the way. And I was like, you know what, that's AA and that's the Atlantic group in action. It was a tremendous experience. So I guess what I just want to say is that early on when I was in sobriety, I heard an elderly woman speak. And she got up and she said, you know, God doesn't show up when I want him to, but he's always on time. And that's the way I feel about this group and this great opportunity. And I just want to thank everybody for the support.
And our main speaker tonight is Liz.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Liz, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm really, really excited to be here. I want to thank Randy for asking me to speak. I want to thank our first two 10-minute speakers who did an excellent job. I also want to put a shout-out to the phone calls that Melissa was talking about, because almost 20 years ago, I made that phone call, and I was sent a meeting list. And I went to my first meeting, and I haven't had a drink since. So that's important work. And if you're new, or if you have the time requirement, I really encourage you to do it. I did it when I turned 1 year in Boston, and it was a really wonderful experience. I'm going to give you my vital statistics. My sobriety date is January 28th, 1997. Like I said, in about a week or two, I'll be celebrating 20 years of sobriety. And I honestly cannot believe I'm this old. I have a sponsor. Her name is Cindy. She lives in Montana. And I spoke to her before the meeting. And you might hear me speak of a woman named Thea, who was my sponsor for 12 years, who I met in this room, who took me through the big book and changed my life. I am currently practicing steps 10, 11, and 12, actually doing it now, not like in the past. And I have a home group. It's called the Marlboro Monday Night Group in Marlboro, New Jersey. Oh, my God. It means at 8:30 Monday nights at St. Gabriel's Church. So if you find yourself in Marlboro, New Jersey, first ask yourself why, and then come on over. I came walking into the room, into this room, this very room, I want to say about, 14 years ago. I was coming out of 6 years of untreated alcoholism. My life was incredibly small. I was in a lot of pain. And I couldn't understand why I was behaving the way I was when I hadn't had a drink in 6 years. And if you're in this room and you have some time away from a drink and you are wondering why your life might not be where it is or why it is and you just feel incredibly ungrateful, I have a message for you. And if you are here tonight and you are wondering how you're going to make it through the rest of the night without drinking, I have a message for you too. I have good news and I have bad news. The good news is it can be done. You can make it through the rest of the night without a drink. The bad news is you can't do it. You can't do this by yourselves. I need this room full of people, whether I'm here or here in spirit, to hold me up. I need a power greater than myself to keep me away from that drink every day. So I came into this room 6 years away from a drink, feeling like my life was falling apart. And I'm going to back up a little bit. The reason I came here is because I had a sponsor who told me that I was selfish and to go get friends. I didn't understand what sponsorship meant. I thought sponsorship was someone that you called 30 times a day and left 20-minute messages about, you know, your fears and frustrations about your love life. I didn't really understand the whole concept of taking direction, asking for direction. I thought sponsors were people that you give a confessional to versus someone you ask before you react. So I had this sponsor who sat me down. So I was sniffing around the rooms of AA for 6 years. It's not like I just didn't drink. I would go to a meeting and I'd take phone numbers and then I would never call, or I would call too much, or I'd go to this meeting or that meeting. I'd go in and out. I would work the steps sometimes, not out of the book, or, you know, I thought it was the easier, softer way. It was actually the most convenient way, which turned out to be very inconvenient because there was a lot of amends from that time. So I had this sponsor, and she told me, she's like, I have a sponsor, I have a family, and I have other sponsees, and I need you to go make friends. And I didn't know how to do that. So I pulled from my arsenal of experience, and I just started stalking the people. I would go to meetings, and I'd hear these phenomenal women speak who looked like me, who just had this glow about them that just, there was just something so happy and free about them. And I follow, and every time they spoke, they said they were a member of the Atlanta group. Without fail, I couldn't believe it. Every time, no matter where in the city, there was that woman who spoke, who had that light, who I was attracted to, and, you know, I wanted what they had. Without fail, they were the Atlanta group. So I followed them here to this meeting. And I'm still friends with them. In AA, it works to stalk sometimes. We like it when you call, within reason, of course. So I started coming, and I started sniffing around, and my first service commitment ever, up until that point in my sobriety, was Dayton gave me the commitment to put away the big book down in the closet downstairs. And I took that commitment very seriously because nobody had ever trusted me with anything. And it was made very clear to me, if you can't do it, find somebody else who can cover for you. And then let the person know who's in charge of your commitment that you're not coming and someone's covering it for you. And now, if you're like me, I don't like really being told what to do, but I work really well with direction. So that was very clear. I had marching orders. This is what you do. This is your expectation. And if you can't do it, this is the expectation how to handle it. It was very clear. Got it. Big book. Cabinet. Cover. Got it. And that was the beginning of my journey here at the Atlanta Group. Like I said, I met Thea. And I asked her to sponsor me. And she said, have you ever done the 12 steps? Or she said, have you ever read the big book? And I said, well, I have a big book. And she said, have you ever done the 12 steps? And I'm like, of course I've done the 12 steps. She said, well, why don't you come in next week, bring your fourth step and let me take a look at it and we'll go from there. And I said, no problem. So I came in with my fourth step and she opens it up and she said, where's the last two columns? And I said, what do you mean the last two columns? And she said, okay, so we're going to start at step one, and you're going to meet me at 23rd and 1st, back where the Sunday night meeting used to be, and you're going to meet me there every week, and we're going to read the big book line by line, word for word, and we're going to do the steps right out of the book. And I was so, oh, and there was other things too, like crazy things, like you have to call me every day, and you have to meet me at 23rd and 1st every Sunday, and here every Tuesday, and somewhere else every whatever, and just, you know, and you have to the service commitments, and oh, she told me I had a sponsor at the time. I was like, that's horrible. Like, I'm sorry, I'm just not the sponsoring type. And Thea said to me, I don't really care what type you are. So I got some sponsees after I did some work. And So it's so interesting when I think about my story and I think about you guys a lot. I recently moved back to New Jersey, which is where I'm from. I'm back, not just to my hometown, but actually to the house I grew up in, which is an interesting experience. And when I say things like reading the big book line for line, word for word, I mean, most of you have done that, right? Like, I see you in your little groups and your pods and your sober families reading out of the big book. And I really did not know. I didn't comprehend what a special, unique place this was. I mean, I knew it was for me when I came in at six, but it's very, the rest of the, it's unusual. It's unusual to find this many people who are as committed to the 12 steps as I am. And I'm so glad that this group is still here and that it's still still just as amazing and colorful and lively as it was when I first came in. Let me tell you a little bit about my drinking. So I heard in a meeting when I first got sober that there's a kind of loneliness that only an alcoholic knows. And much like Rich's, get a commitment, bro, that was the line that really spoke to my heart. Because I had such a deep, profound loneliness that I could be standing in a room full of people and feel completely alone. I used to sit in my parents' basement in the middle of summer, listening to Christmas music, drinking red wine, wondering why I was by myself. Thea would say, only an alcoholic would treat loneliness with isolation. When I found drinking, and you hear this all the time, I felt like there was finally the one thing that I could do. I felt that I was just came into the world damaged and wrong and an excuse for a person. I felt like the oxygen I was breathing belonged to someone else. I didn't feel like I was human. And so when I found alcohol, all those feelings didn't matter. It didn't matter that I was always 3 days past the due date or 10 cents short of a dollar. Like none of that mattered because I was loud and I was fun and I was social and as we do, I just went too far. I was doing too much of the wrong thing with the wrong people and I kept ruining friendships, ruining relationships, driving while intoxicated, because how else would you get home from the bar? Getting kicked out of colleges, multiple times. My first GPA in college was a 0.068. And I could not understand why. And along the way, people would say, maybe you shouldn't drink so much. I'm like, but I have to. Like, it's not the drinking, it's everything else. It's my overbearing mother. It's my inability to get a boyfriend. I'm a terrible student. I can't do well in school. It's all these other things. I remember I got into the college that I got kicked out of twice. I remember walking across this beautiful campus in the beautiful fall, just the sun beating off the walls of these stone walls of these buildings and just praying for a brick to fall out of the sky and just kill me. Just take me out. I can't believe this is how it's happening, what's going on. Meanwhile, people are playing frisbee and writing poetry and, you know, living the college life. And I was drinking a lot of Jack Daniels. So I got kicked out. And then I moved around a lot. I did these geographics. I went to college here and I went to college there, kicked out of that one. And eventually, I moved up to Boston just because I had nowhere else to go. Someone offered me a room and I was doing the same exact thing in Boston that I was doing in Baltimore. It was really weird. It wasn't the same people, but I was behaving the same exact way, except it was getting worse. Up until the time I got sober, I thought everybody blacked out when they drank. I thought everybody drank until, I don't even know when I would stop. I didn't know people who had just one. I mean, I'm sure I did, but I never really spent time with them. or I just wasn't taking notice. I just thought, this is, you know, like, why would you not, why would you stop? Like, why would you? I look at my husband, he doesn't drink. I'm like, why don't you drink? And he's like, you should go to a meeting or call your sponsor. Thanks. So I moved up to Boston, and I was doing the same exact thing. And but the most peculiar thing started happening. And what happened was my life started getting a little bit better. I started doing better in school. And so that was really one of my main reasons. That was one of my main excuses for drinking. You know, my mother was still overbearing, but not so much. I had sufficiently isolated her from my life. And I was still doing this. So things were starting getting better, but I was still drinking the way that I was. And the other peculiar thing was the alcohol stopped working for me. I don't know if that happened to you, where I could drink a sip of wine, I'd be completely intoxicated, or I could drink two quarts of Jack Daniels and be stone cold sober. And that's a terrible place for an alcoholic to be. So one of my friends from that first school in Baltimore, who I was very good friends with, he, I used to call people all the time to ask them what was wrong with me. That was another thing that I did, drunk and sober. So, like, if you know, when you walk down the street and you see, like, tarot, I don't know, people still do it, tarot card readers and, like, palm readers, they knock on their window. They're like, come in, come in. And everyone's like, no. Like, that's weird. I'm not coming into your store. I'd always go in and be like, tell me, what's wrong with me? What do you see in my future? Like, why am I behaving like this? So I called my friend and I asked him what was wrong with me. I don't know why I thought he would know. And he said, well, I don't know what's wrong with you, but it's weird you're calling today. We haven't spoken in a while. Today is my anniversary. I've been sober for a year. And I was like, wow, that's great. You are a mess. So I'm going to go and, good luck with that. And that was the end of December. And then as soon as I got home from New Year's Eve on January 28th, it's actually January 24th. I woke up on the floor of my apartment, and it was just again. It wasn't, my last drink was not very special. I didn't, you know, it wasn't like Bill Wilson. I didn't rent a plane to complete a jag, or I didn't wake up in like Tahiti. I just woke up on my apartment floor, or the apartment that I was living in, you know, empty bottle of wine, phone book on the phone, and the phone, like, there was no cell phone, so like I couldn't see who I called. So I had to start calling people and be like, did I call you? Or can you call so-and-so to see if I called them? And who do I have to apologize for? And all that stuff. And so I couldn't believe I had done it again. So I had this moment. This moment of willingness. This tiny little crack. It's like I remember the sun shining in that apartment. I don't think I had shades. I remember the sun shining in this bright, bright summer sun. I was laying on the floor. And it was like, there's this comedian who calls it like God's flashlight. And I felt like it was pointing right at me, like, you are busted. Here's your chance. And I don't know what it was that compelled me to do it. To this day, I have no idea, except that I have a friend who did it before me. And I went over and I called 411, because that's what you did. And I asked for the number of Al-Anon. Probably not why you think. I asked for the number for Al-Anon because I thought Al-Anon and AA were the same thing. And the operator actually connected me to AA. I think it's probably because I was slurring. So I got connected to AA, and I got, like Melissa was saying, someone was there to answer the phone. Now, I was 21 at the time, and I have a very clear memory of this being an old man, although I have no proof of that whatsoever. I sort of explaining my plight and talking to him, crying, slurring, and he kept saying to me over and over, are you too young to die? Are you too young to die? Are you too young to die? And I was like, you don't seem to understand. He's like, I don't think you seem to understand. How about this? I'll put a meeting list in the mail. Don't drink until you get it. And then go to a meeting. And then decide. That seemed reasonable. So I got my meeting list, and so that was a Tuesday. I got my meeting list in the mail on a Wednesday, and I went to my first meeting on a Thursday. And my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous began. That meeting was at a basement right off of Copley Square. Some of you know, the name of that meeting is Axe Murderers, or at least that's what people call it. Bob tells me it's still there, which makes me really happy. And as soon as I got there, I just knew. There are some people who come in here and they don't want to see, you know, afraid of, oh, a bunch of men in trench coats. I wanted men in trench coats. I drank with men in trench coats. So I walked into that meeting, and I sat down, and I remember two very important things from that meeting. First, the topic was, how do you know when you've had conscious contact? Not really a newcomer topic, but okay. And the second thing that I remember is that there was a girl named Liz, because my higher power loves me, and she invited me for coffee. And as I said, I'm not the social kind, and everything in my body said no, and my mouth said yes, and I got swept up into the young people scene of Boston AA, and it was a lot of fun. And for that first year, I was living on the fumes of fellowship. It was awesome. We went to diners. We went to meetings and went to people's houses and smoked cigarettes and played Trivial Pursuit and drank coffee till the wee hours of the morning. We just had a lot of fun. It was great. I finally had friends. I had my people. I had a pack. And it was awesome. That was what I was looking for when I started coming to AA. And then I moved to the city. I followed a boy, as sometimes you do. And he and I stopped going to meetings together. Because I'd been a year. I hadn't had a drink. Obviously, alcohol wasn't my problem. I had this idea that if you aren't drinking, alcohol's not your problem, right? That makes sense. So I didn't think AA had anything to offer me. Within a couple of years later, I found myself feeling that immense loneliness again, that immense discomfort again. And I had a big book, and I opened the big book. I just was flipping through it. I remember clear as day where I was standing in my apartment at that point in Jersey City, and I was just flipping through it. And the weirdest thing was, because I don't remember reading it, that there was a passage highlighted in this book. So I must have done that, but it never really made any impression on me when I did. But it did this time, and this is what the passage says. It says, we were having trouble with the personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. And it hit me so hard that that has nothing to do with alcohol. But that described me perfectly at 6 years away from a drink. So I made a decision. You know, I made that decision. I was going to try everything I hadn't done before in AA. I was going to give AA one more try. And I started going to meetings with gusto. I started stalking girls. I got a service commitment. I got a sponsor who told me to get a service commitment. And I remember one of my first times getting a service commitment at this point in my sobriety. I went to the 79th Street workshop. And I don't know if they still do this, but they like post all the available commitments. And it's just like the massive wall of paper with all these time slots all during the week. And I kept looking going, I don't know if any of these are going to work for me. I might have something. And then I had this moment where I decided, oh, just pick one. So I picked the 10 p.m. on Monday nights, and then I had to find speakers for that meeting. So I started going to more meetings. The commitment made me go to more meetings, and I felt involved, like Rich was talking about. Like it broke down the barrier of feeling alone and isolated in AA. Because in my experience, there's nothing more painful than feeling alone and isolated in AA. Because if you feel alone in AA, then what's left? It's hard. It's hard to feel like you don't belong here. But as my sponsor Cindy likes to say, we're not walk toward the light kind of people. We're sort of back out of hell people. So it's my unfortunate experience that pain is generally the touchstone to my spiritual growth. Still that case, still that way. Luckily, I don't get into so much pain anymore. Luckily, I've got tools to clean up that pain or the mess that I make when I'm in it. Luckily, my hair is not on fire quite as much as it used to be. Luckily, by actually doing all 12 steps, I'm able to live with my mom and dad and their crazy untrained dog harmoniously most days. I just have a few minutes left, so I was thinking about this is how I wanted to end. Hopefully it works as well as it did in my head. So I have a almost 5-year-old little girl, as some of you may know. She's awesome. And one of her favorite movies is Frozen. So I'm going to talk about Frozen for a minute, and I'm going to ruin the end. So if you don't want to know what happens at the end of Frozen, go like this. So we always talk about how my daughter and I, every time there's the end of Frozen, we talk about, the act of true love, right? There's this one princess who's looking for an act of true love, and she thinks she has to receive it from another person in order to be saved. But it turns out that doesn't quite work out for her. What happens instead is that she does an act of true love for her sister, and that's how they're both saved. So I constantly talk to my little girl, in case she's like me and she's wired a little funny, that true love is not something I'm feeling from someone. It's the things I do for someone. My instinct is never choose love. My instinct is, what's wrong? What do you want from me? What am I not getting? What's missing? What do I have to work harder for? What do I need to push through? So I'm constantly stopping myself and saying, Liz, choose love. Like I have to switch my thinking to choose love. To choose the loving thing, to choose the kind words. And I miss the mark all of the time. My husband will absolutely tell you that. So will my mom. But I know today, like I was told many years ago at one of my very first meetings, somebody got up to the podium and she said, where there is no God, there is no love. And I constantly, if I am here to bring God's grace to this planet, to help my sober brothers and sisters, my humankind brothers and sisters, to just be a good citizen and a good part of a family, to be a good part of a job, to be a loving spouse, to be a good mom, just be a good friend sometimes, then I can't be worried about what you're giving to me, because it will never be enough. It just won't. I'm a bottomless pit of need. But I don't even think about that pit when I'm thinking about you. And when I choose love and I'm focused on what I could bring to you, then my nightly inventory is not so bad. And that's all I have. Thanks.